from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Good Wednesday afternoon to you. I'm Sarah Perry, your host on this, the 22nd of July, 2020. Coming up on today's edition of Washington Watch, Secretary of Homeland Security Chad Wolf held a press briefing yesterday on the chaos, violence, and anarchy in Portland, Oregon, where the city inches closer to the two-month mark of nightly riots and destructions. He made clear that the department would remain committed to the protection of those seeking to peacefully protest, but was quick to clarify that what happens each night after midnight is not in the least peaceful. I'll have a conversation with David Harsanyi, senior writer for National Review, who's just out with his most recent take on the Portland lawlessness. In my second block, I'll have more on the presidential race and a study in candidate contradictions. While a senior White House spokesperson has made clear that the vandalization of Catholic churches and religious statues will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden appeared at a Muslim voter outreach summit and publicly lamented the lack of Islamic teaching in American schools. I've got FRC's VP of Policy and Government Affairs, Travis Weber, with his take on the candidate's religious promises and protests. At the bottom of the hour, Planned Parenthood has finally had to face the music and acknowledge the racist and eugenic roots of the abortion movement in America, removing the name of its late founder, Margaret Sanger, from a Manhattan abortion facility due to what leadership deemed harmful connections to the eugenics movement. I'll have Reverend Dean Nelson, FRC Senior Fellow for African American Affairs, with his prescription for what true racial reconciliation would look like at Planned Parenthood. And in my last block, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he intends to make a second stimulus check part of the next economic relief bill as direct payments to help families keep driving the national comeback. But as congressional talks on coronavirus relief funding continue, everyday Americans increasingly wonder about the security of finances, jobs, and retirement plans. Dan Celia, nationally syndicated radio host and president of Financial Issues Stewardship Ministries, will join me. A reminder, our podcast website for today is TonyPerkins.com. Go there for links to some of the resources we'll be referencing today. Be sure to follow us on social media, FRC on Facebook, and on Twitter at FRCDC, at Sarah P. Perry, or at T. Perkins. And for those of you who have the Stand Firm app, make sure it is the most recent version. We've rebuilt it, so now you can take Washington Watch with you wherever you go.
We support and we will protect those who want to peacefully protest. Unfortunately, what we are seeing in Portland every night, roughly from midnight to 4:30 or 5 a.m., is the complete opposite. Again, what is occurring in Portland in the early hours of every morning is not peaceful protesting. These individuals are organized, and they have one mission in mind: to burn down or to cause extreme damage to the federal courthouse and to law enforcement officers. At times, we also see them targeting city property. These individuals congregate in the same area night after night. We see them planning their attacks, and yet the city of Portland takes little to no action to stop or disperse this crowd. These individuals carry lasers, baseball bats, explosive fireworks, metal pipes, glass bottles, accelerants, and other weapons, all targeting federal facilities and federal law enforcement. And yet the city of Portland takes little to no action.
Ken Blackwell and I discussed yesterday, Democrats are outraged at the use of federal personnel in Portland to enforce laws that the mayor and the governor have refused to enforce. As rioting, looting, and vandalism plagued the city in the late hours of every night since May 28th. The federal actions raise questions about local control or lack thereof. Is the involvement of federal agents the only solution that we are now seeing to violence in a city on the brink? Joining me now to talk about it and his new piece, "The Problem in Portland Isn't the Law, It's the Lawlessness," is senior writer at the National Review and author of First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, David Harsanyi. David, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
I got to tell you, I loved your take on this issue. It was very bitingly witty and very tongue-in-cheek until you got to the very end, and truly was the gloves are off, because the hypocrisy here, particularly in the media's treatment of who these individuals who are clearly violent anarchists, intent on doing harm, very organized, following the same pattern every night, is categorized by the media, which we know is largely beholden to the DNC, as peaceful protests. And yet, as you point out, if these were alt-right protesters or anarchists or agitprops, boy, you can bet it would lead every night in the media. So talk a little bit about the contradiction and how in the world we counter that kind of a narrative.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious when we think about the Charlottesville Nazi march, you know, the Tiki Torch Nazi guys who marched. And, you know, it was an ugly thing that happened and someone died. But it was a major story, as if the entire country had been subsumed by this march and that Nazis were everywhere. Yeah. And now you have a bunch of cities. It's not only Portland. It's parts of Seattle. It's Denver. It's Chicago in a different kind of way, you know, with violence. Now, people will tell me it's largely peaceful. They constantly say it's largely peaceful, which is always going to be true unless they're burning down the entire city.
Right.
Yes, it's largely peaceful. But, you know, that's not how we judge these things. You know, the Twin Towers fell, not all of the city, and it was still a horrifying event. Now, I'm not saying that this rises to that level, but the idea that these are just some sporadic and unimportant protests is just simply not true. You can't have a bunch of anarchists every day trying to firebomb the Portland courthouse,
right,
a federal courthouse. It's a federal building. Now, if it was up to me, I would let these cities deal with it themselves, frankly. You know, if this is what the voters and the businesses and the people who live there want, that's fine. But I think that the federal government has a real interest and cause to go and try to protect federal property, federal monuments, and definitely a courthouse. So I think, just to jump off this topic for a split second, I mean, I think you could be critical of how maybe police sometimes act. That's certainly a fair thing to talk about. But the idea that there are some kind of stormtrooping Nazis who are coming in to take
right.
over Portland is just laughable.
And I'm glad that you said that, because Pelosi did categorize them as police stormtroopers who are, quote, kidnapping protesters. And the New York Times headline today was unconscionably opinionated. It came with a very clear perspective, talking about how this was a trial run in stealing the election, and the title read, "Trump's occupation of American cities has begun," end quote. How now, of course, we know the problems the New York Times has. The old gray lady has been fraught with her own internal discord for quite some time. But the fact that you can even run a headline like that and purport to be intellectually honest, I find stymieing, because this is something that previous presidents have utilized. He has constitutional authority to utilize federal troops when there are periods of civil unrest. And in fact, I will draw our listeners' attention to our podcast, TonyPerkins.com website or FRC.org, in which we link to a letter in which 50 retired flag rank officers have said, military officers have said, listen, we have seen active combat, and there comes a point at which the Insurrection Act of 1807 is your only option. Eisenhower invoked it. Kennedy invoked it. And yet when Trump does it, everyone's up in arms and pearl clutching because somehow this is an illegal occupation of the city. These police, the feds, they are not breaking any laws. And yet the masked anarchists, I could name quite a few that they are breaking.
Right, and also the idea that federal police officers, listen, again, I don't love the idea of militarized kind of police being around, though I don't know that that's really happening here. But when I see some kind of, you know, tank or camouflage, I don't like that. But I don't know that that was really happening here. I think it's kind of a limited engagement where they're just protecting a certain few blocks from these anarchists that show up every single day. But I hate to break the news to people, we have federal agents undercover all the time all over the country with
yes.
the FBI, with the ATF, with the Marshal Service. It's not, you know, they make it sound as if this is some crazy idea that federal police officers can show up anywhere. It happens all the time. In fact,
right.
many, many times when there's some sort of racial crime or what have you, you have cities calling in federal help from the FBI usually. Happens all the time. And the Portland mayor, the Seattle mayor, they're sympathetic in some way. I'm not saying they're anarchists, but they're sympathetic to the left wing cause. And that makes them act very differently with people like this. If these were Nazis doing this, you can bet that they would have called in the federal troops a long time ago.
Right, right. And in fact, the police union president, Daryl Turner, himself has said, listen, the mayor has abdicated his duty. He has essentially just turned the entire city over to the rioters. And these police are on the front lines every night. And as Secretary Wolf said, this is a situation where these guys are being essentially in the line of fire during an onslaught from 12:30 to about 5 a.m. And since May 28th, 425 demonstrations, peaceful or otherwise, and 260 direct attacks at federal facilities across the country. So at some point, you have to say, listen, none of us like militarized force. None of us like the presence of federal agents. As you rightly pointed out, they are all over, whether you like it or not. They have the authority to do that. But there comes a point at which you say, okay, we're at the two-month mark. Our federal courthouse is burning. Our businesses are being looted. We are being essentially attacked. And I cannot think of a better synonym for this, because ultimately this is what it rises to. These individuals are intent on destruction, and it's truly a form of sort of urban warfare. There has to come a point at which a president says, listen, as the commander in chief, I have the authority to send in additional troops or send in DHS agents so that I can protect these individuals who want to live lawfully, who don't want their businesses burned to the ground.
All right. I mean, I'm basically a free speech absolutist. I would say that it's fine. You want to sit out there all night and chant? That's fine. But that's not what's happening here. We see it, and there's a video all over the place. Maybe not on network TV, you know, news TV or cable TV, but it's out there where you have these people who are anarchists, and they say they are, and they cover their faces because they know they're breaking the law,
right?
Undermining city life, intruding on other people's civil rights. There's a balance there where you simply can't, you know, a mayor can't simply hand a city over to a bunch of people just because they are mad about something. I don't even know what they're mad about, to be honest. So, and that's fine. Again, they want to sit out there all night. That's fine. But they firebomb the courthouse one day, right?
Right,
so
right.
You cannot. I don't really know how to stress enough that that's not okay. We can't have a debate about anything. We can't have a civilized society if we look the other way when people do that sort of thing. It's illegal, and it's
right.
Violent, and people can die, and people can get hurt.
David Harsanyi of the National Review has been my guest. Check out his recent column at the National Review online. We have to ask ourselves whether or not this is any longer about George Floyd or racial equality or social justice or the evolution of policing. It has now amounted to violence, rioting, and destruction. We have to ask ourselves what this is truly about and the best way to solve the issue at hand. Coming up, we've got a study in contrast between a Democrat and a Republican vying to occupy the highest office in the land. Which one? I'll give you a guess, bemoans the lack of Islamic instruction in public school. We'll talk to FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, Travis Weber, right after this on Washington Watch. Stick around.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Absent fathers, distracted fathers, and angry fathers have created a vacuum of the soul in the lives of many children. Pornography is epidemic, affecting the male brain, isolating his heart, and degrading women who long to be cherished. Confusion and even skepticism about marriage run rampant, especially in our younger generations. Selfishness among men has led to broken homes and a trail littered with broken hearts, including their own. Where can you turn to find the solutions to these problems? Leadership in Love, A Tale of Two Fathers, is a new publication from Family Research Council that takes a look at two men, Joshua and the father of the prodigal son, as strong examples of leadership and love. It also weaves in an understanding of attachment science to underscore the needs of children, which need to be met to become emotionally healthy and spiritually strong. Visit frc.org/fathers to learn more.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry sitting in with you on this 22nd of July, 2020. My guest in this segment is Travis Weber, FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs. Travis, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So we talked a little bit yesterday about the contentiousness of this election year and how Joe Biden seems to be taking a new tact as concerns chipping away at that evangelical base that's been so uniformly supportive of President Trump. But let's add in another element of religious support. I'm using air quotes around support. As concerns public schools, he appeared recently at a Million Muslim Voters Summit and had a particularly interesting thing to say about what he wished there was more teaching of in public schools. So let's start here with the quote.
I wish we taught more in our schools about the Islamic faith. I wish we talked about all the great confessional faiths. It's one of the great confessional faiths. And what people don't realize is one of my avocation is theology, don't realize is that we all come from the same root here in terms of our fundamental basic beliefs. And I just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity, for being engaged, for committing to action this November. You're doing what's been that's never been done before. You're registering and turning out 1 million Muslim voters this November.
Come at me with all of your faiths, because I am the candidate of all religious faiths. You know, we heard a lot yesterday about the fact that John McCarthy, who's his deputy political director, has positioned him as a devout Catholic, and that faith messaging is baked into the core of who he is and the core functions of the campaign. That's a direct quote. So this is a guy who is presenting himself as the faith choice, the Christian choice, the sort of committed choice when it comes to individual belief systems. And he's here courting a million Muslim voters. What do you make of Biden's commitment, his desire to see more Muslim teaching, more teachings about Islam in public education?
Sarah, I think there's several problems with this. One, imagine if he had said, I want to see the Christian faith taught more. I mean, can we imagine him saying that? I would welcome it, right? And if he's going to welcome religion in the public square in a non-hypocritical way, in a way that upholds religious freedom, true religious freedom, great. But we're not hearing him say that. I don't think we're going to hear him say it. And as far as him trying to engage the faith community, all his positions are at odds with the interest of religious voters. You look at the question of human life, human dignity. He's pushing abortion, pushing the funding of abortion on our country. Despite his claims to position himself as a Catholic, his positions are at odds with a Catholic understanding of the family, an understanding of human dignity and human sexuality that Christians hold to, and religious freedom. The irony of this is President Trump's policies have done more to support religious freedom for all people than most and all modern American presidential administrations through his work internationally, the ministerial to protect religious freedom at the State Department, his international religious freedom initiatives. Many Muslims have benefited from true religious freedom under President Trump. We don't forget about hearing that story. That's the reality of what a policy promoting religious freedom will do. Compared to candidate Biden's attempts to position themselves as purporting to represent religious voters, he actually, his policies would work against them and harm them and hurt their communities.
Yeah, absolutely. That's again, such an important distinction to make. Regardless of how he professes an individual belief, his policy representations, and in particular, what we now have in paper as a joint document, a platform document co-authored with Bernie Sanders, the Socialist of Vermont, it indicates to us it is just as far left as we knew it would be. No surprises. In fact, if there were any surprises, it was just how far to the left the pendulum had swung on his willingness to stand out, not as a moderate, in which he had originally positioned himself, but as indeed the far left socialist aligned candidate of the Democratic Party. So within the same breath, the same Democrats who are pushing to eliminate Christianity, right? No prayer, no pledge, no Christian student groups, no mentions of God, nothing. Now are bemoaning the fact that there is not enough Islam taught in public schools. Contrast that with President Trump, who in an era, in a time period, an unprecedented era, where we have seen the permutation of multiple national crises, and I don't think that's an overstatement, you have an executive order of June 26th in which he has said, listen, we are going to protect not only the historical, but the religious iconography and the symbols and the buildings and the statues that have meant so much to us as Americans. Talk a little bit about how that works individually to help protect those churches who've been recently vandalized.
Yeah, I mean, President Trump's executive order explicitly says we're going to prosecute. It's a policy of the federal government to prosecute religious attacks under the Church Arson Prevention Act. There are other authorities that the federal government can use. President Trump's pledge to stand with attacks, Catholics who are being attacked and their statues of Mary and other Catholic symbols at churches are being attacked. I mean, you look at the record of what's being done, actually, and could contrast that with the words that candidate Biden puts forth. Stark difference. President Trump's actually protecting religious freedom, protecting religious communities. And this is occurring both domestically and overseas. And you look at the other issues. You look at, you know, Biden's support, saying he wants to support the decision of Roe versus Wade, full-throated support for abortion, support for the Equality Act, which would force churches to violate the way they hire and conduct their activities on church property. It's incredible violations of religious freedom that he's saying he's going to implement if he comes into office. And this just escapes much of the press and much of the media and public conversation.
Senior White House official has confirmed that the individuals who vandalized and targeted these Catholic churches and statues will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. What a nice contrast, a refreshing contrast, someone willing to stand in the gap for the beliefs of others and not just pander to those individuals because of their particular beliefs. Travis, thanks for joining me on this segment. Coming up next, we've got Planned Parenthood exercising what appears to be some honesty about Margaret Sanger and the eugenicist and racist roots of Planned Parenthood, removing her name from a clinic in Manhattan. But is it enough? Joining me will be our friend Dean Nelson to talk about what racial reconciliation might really look like for Planned Parenthood. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Not so long ago, sex education in public schools involved learning about human growth and development and listening to advice on how to be careful, respect others, and save sex for marriage. Things are very different today. Parents have two main concerns about sex ed: that it sexualizes children and that it's loaded with LGBTQ indoctrination. Family Research Council has released a new resource to address this issue titled Sex Education in Public Schools: Sexualization of Children and LGBT Indoctrination. This resource reveals troubling examples of the agenda-driven content being pushed in modern sex ed and exposes the powerful organizations behind it all. Finally, it offers some action steps for parents to consider in their fight to protect the health and innocence of their children. For more information about sex education in public schools and to view this resource, visit frc.org/sexeducation. That's frc.org/sexeducation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry. Make sure you are visiting TonyPerkins.com. We've got a bunch of links there, lots of resources, lots of articles and blog posts that you'll want to follow up on so you can get the most out of today's program. Make sure you've got that Stand Firm app as well, and you can take Washington Watch mobile. Planned Parenthood of Greater New York is removing the name of its late founder, Margaret Sanger, from its Manhattan clinic due to the abortion provider's, quote, harmful connection to the eugenics movement, end quote. The decision came after more than 350 current and former staffers and 800 donors to the clinic deemed Sanger a, quote, racist white woman, end quote, according to a report from the New York Times. Of course, it only took decades of denial. Joining me now to talk about it is FRC Senior Fellow for African American Affairs, Dean Nelson. Dean, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Sarah, great to be with you.
Boy, it took a while, and I would imagine now in the conversation we're having about what Black Lives Matter, you have a lot to say about whether or not removing her name from one clinic in Manhattan is sufficient to really rid the organization of a racist connection.
Yeah, well, I was surprised, certainly, to see that Planned Parenthood finally made that decision after over 100 years of denying that Margaret Sanger was racist. So It was great to see that. But the reality is you can't acknowledge the racist person in history without admitting to the racist division that has resulted in nearly 80% of Planned Parenthood's surgical abortion facilities that are in minority communities. And so even if they highlight and acknowledge that, they still have yet to really acknowledge that their vision of what they are still trying to do is part of Margaret Sanger's original eugenics plan.
Yeah, talk a little bit about how Planned Parenthood really targets the Black community. We know that a predominance of these clinics are located in minority areas, but they've really taken this a specific approach toward reaching African-American women with the message of abortion being freeing. Is there some moral superiority they think that they're pulling off on the American populace by continuing to promote the same narrative?
Well, you know, I've referred to it sometimes as the $1 billion lie. I mean, Planned Parenthood first says that they are for women, and they drill down and say specifically that they are for, you know, black women and minority women. And this is a shift. I mean, they've always had that as a vision, but specifically several years ago, they started closing down some of their facilities in places like Hershey, Pennsylvania, and other places like that, and really went to specifically large urban areas to open up mega centers. We've seen one in Houston, Texas. It was opened up several years ago that is the largest in the Western Hemisphere. We've seen other facilities that they've opened up specifically in urban communities. Just last year, right around Father's Day, they opened up a brand new large facility in Charlotte, North Carolina, for instance. It was located in a historically black part of Charlotte. So we've seen this repeatedly. They continue to try to, you know, tell the story, the talking points that they're doing this because they care. But I think all we need to do is to look at those 350 women and former employees at Planned Parenthood that stated, one, that they were racist from their founding, but then they went a step further and said that the practices that they're currently doing are quote-unquote part of systemic racism. So I think that if those who work there every day say that they don't treat black women well, I don't think that we should trust them if they say that they treat black women well who come into their surgical abortion facilities.
Susan B. Anthony, List President Marjorie Dannenfelser, called on Planned Parenthood to publish historical abortion data by race, knowing that there's a skewed placement of these facilities that actively target minority communities. If we get historical abortion data by race, do you think that would be sufficient to finally garner attention, sufficient media attention, and really pull from Planned Parenthood the intellectual honesty that we need from them about how they are actually targeting the African-American community?
You know, it'll be interesting. I mean, I think that Marjorie is right to try to call on them to do that, because we do know that's been their target market. But there are other studies that have shown that. There are a number of groups, I think, Protecting Black Life a couple of years ago. We can still go to their website and see that they can trace 79% of those clinics, surgical abortion facilities, are in black and brown neighborhoods. And you can even drill down, and it'll show you from Google Maps where those locations really are. So I think that the evidence is undisputable. Whether they will acknowledge that or not is yet to be seen.
Well, we know that Margaret Sanger has written some heinous commentary, some heinous pamphlets that for years we were told were taken out of context. We knew the truth. Individuals like you and I, who do our homework and we understand the issues and we pay close attention, we know that you cannot take her statements out of context. They scream volumes on their very own. It would be nice to see Planned Parenthood finally end what a eugenic legacy they have built, and taking her name across platforms out as a method of their common vernacular, I don't think is enough to solve an underlying problem of ongoing minority targeting. Reverend Dean Nelson has been my guest in this segment on Washington Watch. Coming up, we're going to talk to President and CEO of Financial Issues Stewardship Ministries, Dan Celia, about the state of the economy and the markets as Congress begins negotiating another round of coronavirus relief legislation before the August 7th recess. That's on Washington Watch. Stick around. We'll be right back. Could you use some timely and original commentary to read this summer, specifically on the issues facing our culture today? FRCblog.com has just what you're looking for. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, members of the Family Research Council team, as well as outside contributors. You can learn about religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Check out this list of a few of our most recent titles. What does it mean to be a woman? D.C. Christians take to the streets to sing, lament, and pray, and prayerfully responding to civil unrest. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and stand for truth. Our blog helps you do just that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at frcblog.com. On April 16th, President Trump and the White House Coronavirus Task Force announced a three-phase plan with guidelines for how states can begin scaling back restrictions. Churches should begin putting in place plans to reopen and operate their ministries according to the guidance of the Centers for Disease Control as state officials begin lifting orders. Here at Family Research Council, we have summarized the White House three-phase plan and how it relates to in-person church meetings and gatherings. Check out our resource, What Pastors Should Know About the White House Plan to Open Up America Again. Our resource offers practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate safely as our country reopens. Visit frc.org/church guidelines to view this resource and learn more. There, you'll also find our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus. Again, that's frc.org/church guidelines.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry sitting in with you on this afternoon. It's rainy here. I don't know if it is where you are, but goodness, we are glad for a break in the heat. I've got some interesting statistics and an even more interesting guest, because the data we're going to discuss today is going to affect you. Every one of us in the country has been affected by the coronavirus, not just our health, however, but our pocketbooks. And despite all the Democratic hue and cry to the contrary, President Trump has managed to keep the economy afloat in the face of an unprecedented national crisis. So we're going to look at the state of the economy and the markets as Congress begins negotiating another round of coronavirus relief legislation, including consideration of potentially a second round of stimulus checks before upcoming August recess. So joining me now to discuss what the relief legislation and market fluctuations might mean for you is nationally syndicated radio host and president of Financial Issues Stewardship Ministries, Dan Celia. Dan, welcome back.
Sarah, it's great to be with you.
So I read something encouraging today of, in all places, the New York Times. And what the New York Times assured me was that, believe it or not, the Paycheck Protection Program and the direct payment stimulus checks have done precisely what they were designed to do, and they've given the economy a boost. Are you hopeful that a second round of stimulus checks might get us over the hump, so to speak?
Well, I think it's definitely going to be helpful, Sarah. It is going to continue to stimulate the economy, hence why Nancy Pelosi says, it's going to be at least August. They're going to try to load up as much of their wish list onto this bill like they have in the past and then get it to the Senate. But, yeah, it's going to help. There's no doubt about it. And I think it's needed. I think we need to do it. Let's keep the momentum going until the economy itself can get back on its feet to keep that momentum going. And I don't think we're that far away from that. I really, really like, Sarah, the proposal to have a payroll tax holiday. Not because I necessarily want a payroll tax holiday, but I think it's probably a great form of stimulus. Now, I don't know if it's going to fly. Mm-hmm. The Democrats don't want it. They know it's going to be good, and they certainly don't want to have that. But I think it's a great bill because it incentivizes companies to bring people back, maybe a few more than they might thought they would bring back. And it's going to incentivize individuals to go back to work. And I think it's a great idea. I hope it happens. I'd much rather see that than a payroll tax cut. I'd rather see the holiday, knowing that January 1st it's going to be over and we're going to get back to normal. So we'll see. But I think the stimulus is a great idea. I'm glad they're doing it.
So we've got some good news out on the Paycheck Protection Program. MIT's telling us it saved anywhere between 1.5 million and 3.5 million jobs. We know that these direct stimulus payments seem to be making an effect as well, that they've done what they were designed to do, and they've boosted the economy into a turnaround. But I'm going to play devil's advocate, and I want to ask you about fluctuations in the market, because Bloomberg, to the contrary, has now said that 401k retirement plans are no longer a sensible option for savers, and that there's just too much market fluctuation. As somebody who runs a ministry like yours, tell me what you think about a statement like that.
Well, I'm not sure what their motive is, but their motives are not to help or encourage people, savers. I don't know what their thinking is there totally. But look, the markets are going to be volatile. Remember, Sarah, yours, mine, anybody else's IRA or 401k is designed and thought of as something long-term. Now, obviously, if you are retiring in 2 years, no kind of plan that you have that is exposed to the market volatility is a good idea. So in that case, yeah, that would be fine. People that close to retirement, they don't want to put at risk their principal going down just before they retire. But that is not mm-hmm. the vast majority of people. So it's a long-term investment, and in 3 years, you're going to be very glad that you stuck with the plan and continued to put money in.
So we've been seeing some irrational movements lately in the market, and that's to be expected. I think anybody who watches 5 minutes of daily news would understand that there are so many factors at play that we can anticipate the market is going to move up and down. But like you said, the S&P 500, you said, really goes officially positive for the year. And then we've got Amazon rising. In fact, I just heard recently that Jeff Bezos himself had something like a $12 billion day. Not that I necessarily want $12 billion to accrue to Jeff Bezos individually, but the market going up is good for all of us. So it's amazing to me that we have really had a series of excellent days. Does this portend well for the future?
Well, it's irrational, the gains. And you mentioned the S&P 500. The gains in the S&P 500, 25% of those gains come from four companies. Remember, 500 companies, the majority of the gain, it's not the majority speaking, but a quarter of the gain is certainly the majority that any companies are receiving, and that's all in four companies. And they're all and the six companies, the six top companies, what we call the FANG stocks, make up totally getting close to 30% of the gain. So I wouldn't be real excited about being in the S&P 500 if I were an investor for the next 3 or 4 years, because I think these technology stocks or these FANG stocks have been irrationally going up, going up, going up. And yet their earnings reports are showing that it's almost warranted. But I think it's a little irrational.
So no need to necessarily get too excited if you hold a ton of investments in the S&P. So do you think that investors are going to be paying a little bit more attention to the economic data, particularly this week, particularly as Congress continues to debate another stimulus package? Are they going to be watching what the economy does closely?
Well, I think they're watching earnings closely. I think they're watching to see. Right now, earnings have been way better than expected. Now, the middle of next week, we will be a little bit closer to the heart of earnings season, and a lot more companies will have reported. But right now, it's pretty amazing how it looks, and I think they're watching that very closely. And here's the thing, Sarah. There is a correlation between the reality of the economy, because the economic numbers have been very, very good. We had a record existing home sales number today, something we've never seen. And I suspect
amazing in the midst of all of this.
It is amazing. And we had consumer confidence index numbers very close to 100. And it was 98.8. And let me just put that in perspective. During the Obama administration, he had maybe 3 months in the last 2 years of his term that were over 98%. So President Trump's administration has been well into the 100s, something we hadn't seen in 13 years. And the consumers are feeling really good. And that tells us a whole lot about the reality of the economy.
Yeah, it really does. And interestingly, Dan, I think there can be an argument made that that kind of economic sentiment can translate into potentially voter sentiment. You know, to quote James Carville, and there's only one line for which I quote him, it's the economy, stupid. It really always is. People are going to vote. They're going to vote when they feel that their bottom lines, their jobs, their paychecks, their retirements, their savings accounts for their school, college set asides, when those are affected. And so in a situation like this, where we've got home sales up and we've got consumer confidence indexes up, I find it very interesting because the economy drives so much of what drives people to the polls in the first place. Now, we know that federal unemployment benefits are going to stop in July. So is that going to have an impact on this, or has it had an impact on the U.S. economy?
No, I think it has had a positive impact on the economy, them having it, but it going away, I think it's going to incentivize people to go back to work. I mean, I think that there is a group of people that are logically saying, it doesn't make sense to go back. I'm not going to go back. And I think when this goes away, it's going to incentivize those people to say, all right, I'm ready. I've been out long enough. I'm going to get back to work. And I think it's going to be a good thing in the long run for the economy. And it's got to be something good in November. I can't imagine there could be a whole lot of people that don't understand that the last thing we'd want is a Biden administration that to build back what has been lost. When we have a track record of somebody that we know can build this back, and everybody, whether they want to admit it or not, has to have a lot of confidence in that.
Absolutely. Well, and we know if you listen to Joe Biden, he's willing to spend $10 trillion over 4 years on a climate plan that is full of pork. It's essentially the Green New Deal that's been shined up and repackaged in a completely different format, but it's ultimately the same thing. So we know where his financial priorities are. Now, we've seen some stops and starts with the economy, right? So we've seen some states sort of open up and phase through their openings. And then as there have been correlations and surges with coronavirus cases. Some of them have actually rolled it back and they've gone back a stage or even two stages. Is that going to have ultimately a long-term outcome on the economy, or are we essentially banking on the fact that what we've seen so far will continue and that what's worked in the past will continue to sort of propel the economy through for the rest of the year?
Well, I don't think it's going to have a lasting long-term impact, but it certainly is going to have a short-term impact on the economy. I don't believe it's going to have much of an impact on markets. I said earlier that markets are a little irrationally high, and I believe that. But at the same time, markets are smart. Sarah, they're very seldom wrong. Markets and market makers are smart. And what they know is exactly what you and I are talking about. They understand that the cause of all of this, and they understand that when the cause is diminished, this economy, not the market, the economy is going to pick up where it left off in where it was January 30th very quickly. And they know that, and they're going to be well positioned because they're buying in now. They're going to be well positioned to then sit back and take advantage as the economy catches up with the valuations of the stocks. And that's going to happen, and they know that.
If we see continued spiking in coronavirus diagnostics or in coronavirus deaths, is that going to have an impact on our economy?
Well, the issue with all of that is the vast majority of people, even those on Wall Street, I don't think they believe the numbers. And, you know, we're looking at numbers that are all over the place. And everybody is taking this position. I don't know who to believe. Now, me personally, I'm believing what's on Main Street. And what's on Main Street is a whole lot of people that see the reality of Main Street, and they're still spending, they're still buying, they're buying homes, they're getting mortgage applications at a high that we haven't seen in 17 years. And they are more than willing to be confident about what is coming. They wouldn't, if they were feeling themselves the effects of these higher numbers, and if they're not feeling it, who is feeling? So I think that caused so much of it in question that it's not having the impact that the left would like it to have on consumers, or I'll put it this way, on voters, that they would like it to have. People know the reality of what's happening on the street, and we, Sarah, live in a consumer-driven economy. Nothing else.
Yes.
Not an export driven, not a manufacturing driven economy. We, 71% of our economy is based on you and I, Sarah and Dan, feeling good about what's happening and being willing to spend some money. Maybe we're spending it on Amazon from home, or maybe we're ordering from Walmart at home, but we're still spending money. We're not. Let me draw a comparison. During the Obama administration's first 3 years, the opposite was happening. As they were saying the economy's getting better, people were hunkering down.
So we've got an economy and markets that are showing signs of promise and responding well to what the president and the administration has done so far to get the job taken care of. This has been Washington Watch. I've been your host, Sarah Perry, and I'll be with you tomorrow on the Thursday edition.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.